On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we have Mr. Curtis Franco and Mr. Brian Chi here today. Are you ready for disaster recovery? Well, the pandemic period has put us on high alert, and we'll take you through 9 cyber disaster recovery planning tips to help you out. Plus, we have a great guest today, Larry Gadia. He's the CEO of Envoy. Take us through what the future of work and the workplace will look post-pandemic. You shouldn't miss it. Quiet on the set. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Securing every access point in your company doesn't have to be a challenge. LastPass unifies access and authentication to making securing employees simple and secure, even when they're working remotely. Check out LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twiat, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 418, recorded November 6th, 2020. Back to work with Envoy. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by IT Pro TV. Get professional IT training with the experts. Visit itpro.tv/enterprise for an additional 30% off all consumer subscriptions for the lifetime of your active subscription. Use code ENTERPRISE30 at checkout. And by Thinks Canary. Detect attackers on your network while avoiding irritating false alarms. Get the alerts that matter. For 10% off and a 60-day money-back guarantee, go to canary.tools/twit and enter the code TWIT in the How Do You Hear About Us box. And by Worldwide Technology. WWT's Advanced Technology Center is like no other testing and research lab, with more than $500 million of equipment, including solutions from key partners like Intel Corporation. And it's virtual, so you can access it 24/7. To learn more and get insights into all that it offers, go to WWT.com/twit. Welcome to Twiat, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that's dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world's connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide through this big, giant world of the enterprise. But I can't guide you by myself, but what better way to go on this journey and bring in some of the top industry tech professionals, starting with our very own geek in paradise, Mr. Brian Chi. He's also the net architect over at Sky Fiber, and he's also in the great state of Hawaii. Chibert, welcome back to the show, my friend. You're not too much longer in the Aloha state, are you?
No, my best estimate is about 6 weeks. So the first loadout's going next Thursday, Friday, maybe. That's going to be the vast majority of our household goods. Then we finish the house renovations, put it on the market, and not too long after that, we join Curtis in the Sunshine State. So that'd be interesting.
Right. Yeah, well, good luck with all of that. Good luck with that. Well, speaking of Curtis, Mr. Curtis Franklin, he's a senior editor over there at Dark Reading and a heck of a busy guy. Curtis, welcome back to Twiat. How's the Sunshine State treating you?
Well, the Sunshine State is in good shape, and I can't tell you how happy we are to not be the focus of election attention this year. Regardless of what you thought about the way the state went in the vote, the fact that we did get the vote done, and we're just sitting back and watching other parts of the country now. It's a lovely break from previous years. On a professional note, I've got an outstanding virtual event happening next week, and we are getting ready for Black Hat Europe. I've got some stories that are going to be coming up based on the talks that are happening there. So as you say, it's a busy time here in the Sunshine State.
Well, folks, speaking of a busy week, we've definitely had a busy week in the enterprise. Are you ready for disaster? Well, the pandemic period has put us in heightened alert, and we're going to go through 9 cyber disaster recovery planning tips to help your organization. Plus, we have a great guest today, Larry Gadia. He's the CEO of Envoy, and he's going to take us through what the future of work and the workplace will look like post-pandemic. But before we get to all that goodness, let's go ahead and jump into this week's news blips. Now, cloud computing has been a huge topic for us, especially over the last year, and people continue to digitally transform at a record pace. Cloud providers need to ensure they have high availability in regions to ensure performance, low latency response, and even disaster recovery. Well, AWS is spending some cash for its business to help a little bit here. Now, Amazon Web Services has announced plans to build a second AWS region in India, spending $2.8 billion to build out the infrastructure. Now, the new region will be located in the Hyderabad Tech Hub and becomes part of the AWS Asia Pacific Cloud. Now, Hyderabad's upcoming infrastructure region is the latest in the long series of investments that AWS continues to make in India. Now, Hyderabad region is expected to come online in mid-2022, now bringing AWS's total global regions up to 29 if operational and in-progress regions are also included. Now, AWS currently has 77 availability zones across 24 regions today. Sounds impressive, but this is the latest expansion that also has to compete with Microsoft Azure. Now, Azure has a presence in the west, central, and southern portions of India since 2015. However, AWS does say the forthcoming Hyderabad region will help developers, startups, enterprises, education, and nonprofits run their applications and serve end users from data centers located directly in India. What this also means is that if you're developing a global application or a line of business application, you can also have a much more localized offering in that region. Now, as cloud providers continue to grow their offering, it makes them more and more compelling for organizations as they consider the challenge of digital transformation.
Well, online users feel safe, but risky behavior is more the norm than not. Most home users and workers consider their devices sufficiently secure, but more than a third never check for updates to their security software, and more than half regularly connect to unprotected Wi-Fi networks. That's according to a new report from the National Cybersecurity Alliance. The research shows a divide between younger users and older users of technology, though a big split isn't necessarily along age baselines. A bit more than a third of people were working from home due to the coronavirus pandemic, but far more younger people, that's 47% of 18 to 34-year-olds, make up the remote working population. Most remote work employees, however, did not take additional steps to secure their devices, steps like using two-factor authentication and updating security software. The report, based on a survey of 1,000 Americans, suggests workers and home users have too much confidence in how well they've secured their devices against online threats. For the most part, 18 to 34-year-olds tend to have better security practices than 50 to 75-year-olds, with 89% of the younger group at least somewhat likely to use two-factor authentication compared with 70% of older people. In addition, 83% of younger people check their software updates at least every 2 to 3 weeks compared with 63% of older people. Yet, many of the shortfalls in security came from work-from-home habits, with only 39% of all workers using two-factor authentication on all their devices and 38% regularly updating their antivirus, anti-malware, and firewall software. You know, those work-from-home habits also show older and younger people focus on different types of security. More younger users enable two-factor authentication on their devices, for example, yet only a third of them update their anti-malware and firewall software, compared with almost half of users in the 50 to 75-year-old group. And younger users are almost twice as likely to use public Wi-Fi hotspots compared to older users. Now, for organizations, the survey could inform training content for different generations of employees. Older workers, for example, may need to be introduced to the latest technologies, while younger workers will likely have to be taught more to be more cognizant of risks. In addition, companies should make sure they are focusing on creating a secure infrastructure for all their distributed workforce, no matter how old they are.
Well, the SpaceX Starlink public beta begins. It's $99 a month and $500 up front, and I'm really jealous. SpaceX has begun sending email invitations to Starlink's public beta and will charge beta users $99 per month, plus a one-time fee of $499 for the user terminal, mounting tripod, and router. The emails are being sent to people who previously registered interest in the service on the Starlink website. One person in Washington State who got the email posted it on Reddit. Another person who lives in Wisconsin got the Starlink public beta invitation and passed the details along to Ars Technica via email. SpaceX is calling it the better than nothing beta, perhaps partly because the Starlink satellite service will be most useful to people who cannot get cable or fiber broadband. But the email also says, as you can tell from the title, we are trying to lower your initial expectations. Expect to see data speeds vary from 50 megabits to 100 megabits and latency from 20 to 40 milliseconds over the next several months as we enhance the Starlink system. There will also be brief periods of no connectivity at all. As we launch more satellites, install more ground stations, and improve our networking software, data speed, latency, and uptime will improve dramatically. For latency, we expect to achieve 16 to 19 milliseconds by the summer of 2021. The Starlink phased array user terminal, which is more advanced than what's in fighter jets, plus mounting tripod and Wi-Fi router costs $4.99 and the monthly subscription costs $99. Now, early reports are quite telling in that testers are reporting back latencies and throughputs significantly higher than early estimates, similar to terrestrial broadband connections. And these are even from in the middle of national parks and forests. And I, for one, would absolutely love to get my hands on a system. And I'm just kind of wondering, you know, I'm retired. I'm going to be on a fixed income. I wonder if I can afford a rig.
Now, the 5G race continues to be an interesting one, to say the least. Now, this week, the FCC announced that T-Mobile would have to pay $200 million in civil penalties related to 5G. Now, the cellular carrier's bad week isn't stopping there, though. The National Advertising Division of the Better Business Bureau, and NAD for short, has examined some of T-Mobile's claims about having the, quote, best 5G network and found that they are potentially misleading to customers. Now, regulating marketing can be challenging because, of course, every company will put its best foot forward in its advertising. However, NAD has found that many of T-Mobile's 5G claims surrounding its merger with Sprint are downright false. Now, specifically, NAD took issue with T-Mobile saying things like, quote, the best 5G network or highest capacity in history or most reliable network. Now, furthermore, the group said that T-Mobile's ads depicting magenta and yellow beams rapidly shooting from tower to tower, spreading or speeding through server rooms across cities and over vast landscapes are misleading to the average Joe. Who would have thought? Well, the message touting the imminent benefits of the merger are unsupported. Now, this is yet another instance of a carrier going a bit too far, far from lying about 5G. Now, at least this time, to its credit, T-Mobile said it's, quote, supports the self-regulatory process. Surprising, right? Well, plus they said that they will, quote, accept the recommendations to cut back on claims that might make consumers think that T-Mobile's 5G network is indisputably the best right now. Now, I guess this is a win for consumers for now. Hopefully at some point, 5G will become the real deal.
Well, if you're using containers for data analysis, you should know they are chock full of vulnerabilities. Research by a team at Concordia University in Montreal, which focused on containerized applications used in high-performance computing environments for neuroimage processing, analyzed 44 container images using vulnerability scanners and found that the average container image had more than 320 vulnerabilities. Containers based on lightweight Linux distributions, like Alpine Linux, had far fewer vulnerabilities, suggesting that minimizing the volume of code can also reduce the number of vulnerabilities. While the researchers focused on containerized applications of analyzing images of the brain, the issue with vulnerabilities is not particular to that discipline or data science packages, says Tristan Glatard, associate professor in the Department of Computer Science and Software Engineering at Concordia. The research highlights that updating the packages included in images is a proven way for users of Docker and Singularity containers to reduce the number of vulnerabilities in the software. The number of vulnerabilities found varied from about 1,700 for one image to nearly zero for a handful of others. While the average number of vulnerabilities per image was 460, the median image had 321 vulnerabilities. As with enterprise software, data scientists are often concerned that updates will break or at least change their analyses, so they avoid updating the software components in an image, says Guitard. He urged image users to regularly check to make sure that they're using the latest software in their containers.
Well, I apologize. I just realized that my notes for this particular blip are really messed up. I must have pasted the wrong material in. So I'm going to make something up. And just because I'm going to share this new toy. It's, where is it? Come on. So for those of you, that was a Kingston Data Traveler 2000. I've been talking a lot about, you know, being safer and so forth. One of the things I'm planning on doing is this is an encrypted USB drive. You actually plug it in and then you type a code in to decrypt it, be able to use it. You can actually have another code set up so you can use it, but only read only, which is pretty cool. So my plan is I'm going to be taking a lot of the encrypted data, my encryption keys, SSH, SSL, and so forth. I'm going to throw that onto that along with, you know, maybe some personal information so that I can actually travel with my keys and not have to have them physically on the laptop or whatever that I'm using. It's going to be interesting. And I do apologize again that it's I'm making this up right now, but we need to be better at how we protect ourselves. Keys, data vaults, any kind of proprietary information, you might want to seriously consider this. This is obviously I'm not supposed to endorse anything, but thank you very much to Kingston for getting it to me. It is really interesting. It's a brand new product. They even have a ENVM module that you can actually plug into different devices that support it. And it self-encrypts. So you plug in, it pulls your data up out of your, I think it's out of the TPM module, decrypts, and then when your system powers down, it's encrypted at rest, which is super, super cool. Anyway, it's a neat, neat product. And Kingston, thank you so very much for letting me get my hands on one so early in the game. And I look forward to telling our viewers a little bit more on how well it's worked when I move all my keys off my system onto an encrypted data drive.
Thanks, Hubert. While millions of Americans live in broadband deserts with no access to anything resembling modern internet service, now some people have it as bad as those who must rely on AT&T's ancient DSL network. Now, DSL used to be a medium to connect to the internet more reliably than other models. Unfortunately, these days, that's less accurate. Now, in some cases, customers are paying $35 a month for just 768 kilobits per second of internet plans. That's not always active, has high latency, and pretty much is barely unusable. Now, after AT&T is contacted about some areas, like, for instance, Raymond, Mississippi, AT&T responded that those areas were ones that AT&T didn't even have to provide connectivity there. Now, wait a second. How did the customers actually sign up and get it installed then? Well, AT&T has received over $283 million from the Federal Communications Commission since 2015 to extend home internet services to over 133,000 potential customers in Mississippi. Now, AT&T says it will exceed that requirement by the end of the 2020 deadline, but the company's mapping mistakes have led to unpleasant surprises for customers who thought they'd get modern broadband. Jeez. Now, in one customer's case, they were told that they would get UVerse, which is still only about 5 megabit per second in their area. But the install technician told them that during the install, they would barely get 1 megabit. That's because the old telephone lines leading to the house are far too far from AT&T's nodes to qualify for fiber to node service that provides faster speeds than basic DSL. Why? Well, because sales and service people have incorrect maps of the service area. Now, coping with horrible internet service has been challenging, especially during the pandemic. Now, AT&T DSL is so inconsistent for families that they can rarely even use it for basic tasks like web browsing. Now, this means that some households must drive almost 50 miles sometimes to get reliable internet for work and school. In fact, we've even heard of plenty of those stories of children sitting outside of schools, libraries, McDonald's to use Wi-Fi during the pandemic. I find that very sad. Now, AT&T has a fixed wireless service in some areas, which the company is using to meet the network expansion requirements it agreed to in exchange for FCC funding. But some homes are actually too far from AT&T's cellular tower to get the wireless home internet service. Now, AT&T is not the only company that's falling short for providing to people here. Now, Comcast and even local providers like CSpire are also falling short. Now, the CWA union and consumer advocacy groups such as Public Knowledge urge the FCC to investigate AT&T's decision to phase out DSL. While other AT&T continues to provide DSL to existing customers, these families are in precarious position as users of a network that AT&T has done little to maintain and make good. Maybe, just maybe, things will get better with Starlink coming soon and as it starts to spread more widely to different parts of the country. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But before we get to the bites, we have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's IT Pro TV. Now, if you've been asked to learn something new for IT, whether for work or just for yourself, your first thought might be on YouTube, right? Well, the problem is with that is it can take hours to look through different videos, and most of the time you don't even know the video that you click on can even help. It's hit or miss. Now, don't waste your time or your money. Just go to IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV is the best online IT education platform where you can learn about IT for every kind of role, whether it's a developer, a help desk support engineer, a network admin, a business professional, sysadmin, or any other role. You'll find exactly what you need to learn with IT Pro TV. And even better, they make it fun. Now, earn full IT certifications through IT Pro TV's online IT training courses. Learn new skills with top-rated IT training videos led by expert IT trainers. Now, IT Pro TV has over 5,800 hours of IT training and 375 combined certifications, so you know you're getting the best IT education around. Now, whether you're a manager of an IT team or an individual looking for IT skills, IT Pro TV has the professional training you're looking for. Now, they are the official video training partner for CompTIA. They also provide Microsoft IT training, Cisco training, Linux training, Apple training, security, cloud, and more. Check out their podcast, TechNado, with Don Pezza. He's featuring industry guests and IT news recaps for a deeper dive into the IT realm. IT Pro TV is focusing on CertNexus certifications for November. Learn more about getting certified as a CyberSec first responder or a cybersecure coder or a certified Internet of Things practitioner. Now, there should be no question here. IT Pro TV is the first and last place you need to go for IT training. Get a professional IT education the right way. Go to itpro.tv/enterprise and use code ENTERPRISE30 to receive 30% off all consumer subscriptions. That's itpro.tv/enterprise and use code ENTERPRISE30 for an additional 30% off for the lifetime of your active subscription. IT Pro TV, build or expand your IT career and enjoy the journey. And we thank IT Pro TV for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the bites. Now, you and your organization are probably already at heightened sense of cyber threats, right? Well, businesses in 2020 have seen an incredible amount of disruption from dealing with the global pandemic response to accelerated digital transformation efforts and more advanced digital business intelligence initiatives and IT, IoT proliferation. Now, think about it. Couple all that with the intense level of geopolitical natural disasters and social unrest, and you now have the makings of an apocalypse movie script. Think about that. Suffice to say, there's a good chance your security plans need some level of overhaul here. Now, you probably need to maybe have some new plays in the playbook. Now, the future of security requires a mindset shift from the traditional detect and response model to approach a more proactive defense. That will help if you also had some plays in there that include additional resiliency plans. Now, to survive and thrive against today's unending and multi-layered threats, companies must become more resilient to any future attacks or blows. Now, organizations cannot stop every threat or disruption, but they can continuously test comprehensive response plans coupled with recovery plans can actually help reduce risk and exposure exponentially. Now, here are some examples how organizations can prepare for it. Start with this. Part of this is that organizations must change response plans from the on deck to supporting more of a remote-based ecosystem, right? Because a lot of more remote workers, a lot more remote IT services. You must be able to communicate remotely and respond effectively. It could be challenging because people usually aren't prepared to respond this way, and it doesn't include comprehensive remote response in most training or playbooks. Now, another thing, planning is one thing, but sometimes organizations have too many tools. I know ours do, and they might not work remotely in a remote setting. Now, siloed and disconnected tools and platforms have created two complex environments that limit context, stifle productivity, and they limit the ability to do work. Now, consolidated technologies reduce that overhead and complexity. Fewer tools also promote efficiency, increased response times, and provide increased visibility and that much needed context that the modern day resilient plans require to detect and respond rapidly. Now let's talk about testing. That's the next part of it. Testing also needs to be considered, right? Well, traditional testing needs a remake to ensure an organization is really genuinely resilient, and it also needs to break through that security training complacency that they've had. Now, in this new environment, no one can really treat a cybersecurity as a responsibility that stops with a core incident response team, right? It's resilient organizations must ensure every person understands and contributes to a culture of situational awareness, active response, and continuous improvement. So now let's talk about what happens after bad things happen. Well, with threats larger, harder, and meaner, the bounce back will take even longer, considerably even more effort. Now, organizations may need to adjust their recovery time objective expectations. Now, understanding that recovery may take longer here. Well, alternatives must also be in place if employees cannot travel to recovery sites or even users' house to recover a compromised system. So having that additional time and knowing that it's going to be there will help. Now, as we know, things will continue to change over time, and changing things can also sometimes break stuff. That's right. We've actually heard a few of some organizations pushing config changes or policy or rule changes, and the networks go down. Well, this means organizations must prepare to prevent that from happening or be able to mend those things on the fly. Now, to ensure security policy changes are adequately analyzed and properly deployed without introducing new risks, organizations need context-aware change management to actually ensure that the decision-making process across the enterprise security and network teams is on the mend. Now, bad actors put your workforce in play on the battlefield. Why not send them through some drills, right? That can help the organizations. They can conduct tabletop exercises with members of the Security Operations Center and even C-level personnel and internal outside counsel and communications or even media personnel. Now, practicing will always help people feel more confident, more prepared, and ready to go. Now, this is a pretty good list, but it's definitely not an exhaustive one. Now, there are plenty more for organizations to do here, but I do want to bring my co-host in because there's a lot more to talk about here. Now, Curtis, attack surfaces are obviously growing, and they're beginning to be a big risk. Is this really a point where organizations are sometimes deprioritizing security initiatives too much, and they need to get that back in the budget?
Well, I don't know that they're really deprioritizing these things. What they're doing instead is prioritizing other things. You know, I've looked at this from some other contexts, like the convergence of IT and OT systems. Those create new and very broad attack surfaces, but companies haven't just gone willy-nilly into it. What they have done, though, is seen the advantages that can come from the convergence of these two wildly disparate networks and said that the advantages of that convergence are such that it overwhelms the other considerations like security and resilience. So I think that what we have is not so much companies that are not paying attention to the resilience side of things and the continuity and recovery, but they're paying a ton of attention to the benefits of these new systems, new processes, and especially the mixed on-premises hybrid cloud architectures that do wonderful things for productivity, wonderful things for capability, and many less wonderful things for resilience and security.
Right, right. Well, Cheaper, now you have some experience here. Can you maybe get into how you've helped some organizations in some cases?
Yeah, I actually really like this list. My favorite is actually the tabletop exercises.
Right, drills. Yeah.
What I used to do with my team and my, quote, customers within the federal government is we used to actually during the design process of a new system, we'd also design testing, and more testing. We would actually schedule it. We'd actually work with the customer to find out when we can schedule in degraded system time so that we can actually go and run real honest-to-God exercise. So one of my favorites is I actually had systems where I would have optical switches and I would actually pretend, you know, we'd have a fast exercise usually in the wee hours of the morning and we'd pretend a base got nuked. And what do you do? What? How well do your procedures work if an entire base or location drops off the face of the earth? If you design that in and get your exercises designed in as part of the design process, all of a sudden a lot more things happen a lot easier. And the active exercises forces you to go and find out how well your procedures work. And gives you a chance to go and fine-tune them. It also allows me to we also design in some randomness. Obviously, in the federal world, we don't want to advertise when we've degraded our networks. So we put some randomness in. But it seemed to work pretty well. And the nice thing is, you know, only the upper echelon knew about it, so that the workers would always treat it as if it was real. And that is, I would say, the ultimate in disaster recovery. Let's call that the nuclear option, won't we?
Right. Well, you know, I do like the model of the tabletop exercises, because this really lets users think about what could be at risk if something terrible happens. And I want to throw this to Curtis, because do you see organizations not doing this enough, and why aren't they doing this enough?
Well, the basic reasons are that it's expensive from a lot of different points of view. I mean, it does take employees away from what are, at least in theory, their productive normal tasks. If you do it right, you're going to have some external experts brought in to conduct and evaluate the exercises. And doing that means that you have to bring on someone who knows how to evaluate the exercises. You know, this is not a set of skills that just anyone has. You have to understand not only what is going on, but what should have been going on and how to get there. Add all of those things up and it becomes very expensive from a cash point of view and from a human resources point of view. And there's always the possibility, though we don't like to talk about it, that in doing one of these exercises, you'll actually break something. And that tends to make the cost skyrocket, as well as giving all of the operational people who depend on the broken system a bad taste in their mouth and makes them very reluctant to sign on for future exercises. Put them all together, and it means that, as you say, these carefully conducted exercises, while critical, are done far less often than they really need to be.
Right. Yeah, I'm actually hoping that some organizations, you know, they jump on the bandwagon here and start doing it more, because they can really get us all prepared. I think we've done these things where we've done these campaigns where we'll send out, you know, maybe even false emails or, you know, spamming or phishing campaigns or something like that, just to see how many people click on it. And then we educate the users when they do it. And I can tell you one thing, people find it slightly annoying, but it is an educational thing, because next time they go around, they don't do it anymore. So, you know, I definitely think that organizations need to do more of this. Let's hope they start doing it. Well, folks, that does it for the Bites. But next up, we want to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. But before we do that, we have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Thinks Canary. Now, with everything that's going on in the world, Thinks Canary wants you to know they are here for you. Now, data breaches are on the rise, and companies usually find out too late that they have been compromised. Even after spending millions of dollars on IT security, Canary is designed to be installed, configured, and most likely forgotten in just minutes. Yeah, if you need to be alerted, Canary gives you the option of deciding how you want to be told, whether it's email or text message or on your console, Slack, webhooks, syslog, or even they're just APIs there. Now, alerts should be dead simple, easy to work with, conforming to your needs, not the other way around. And Thinks Canary has that made that possible. You won't be inundated with alerts either. You'll get the only ones that really matter. Now, two things all companies should know when it comes to data breaches. One, hackers take the path of least resistance. We talked about that a lot. It's really your staff. Now, it takes an average of 191 days for a company to realize there's been a data breach. Well, that's where Canary can come and help. Canary works like this. It looks like an identical to a router, a switch, a NAS server, a Linux box, or a Windows server, so attackers can't tell the difference. Thinks Canary don't look vulnerable on your network. They look valuable and appealing. You can put fake files on them or even enroll them into Active Directory. And when attackers investigate further, they give themselves away. And then you're instantly notified. And the company behind Canary has been in the security game for almost two decades. They've been trained, and they've trained companies, militaries, and governments on how to break into networks and have used that knowledge to build Canary. Now, Thinks Canary are deployed all over the world, all seven continents, and are the best tools against data breaches. Now, visit canary.tools/twit for just $7,500 per year. You'll get five Canaries, your own hosted console, upgrades, support, and maintenance. And if you use code TWIT in the How to Hear About Us box, you'll get 10% off the price for life. We know you'll love Thinks Canary, but if you're not happy, you can always return your Canaries with their two-month money-back guarantee for a full refund. That's canary.tools/twit. And enter the code TWIT in the How Do You Hear About Us box. And we thank Thinks Canary for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's my favorite part of TWiET where we actually get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the TWiET riot. Today we have Larry Getty. He is the CEO of Envoy. Larry, excited to have you here. Welcome to the show.
Absolutely. No worries. Thanks for having me.
Now, obviously, our audience loves to hear origin stories. Can you maybe take us on a short journey through tech and what brought you to Envoy?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's this company's been around since 2013 we started this company. It was I started at Google. I went to Twitter when we were about 40 people, saw an extreme amount of growth really quickly, and then kind of had the Silicon Valley thing. Hey, let's start a thing. Little did I know all the things I was going through at Twitter would come back and with a vengeance when we were growing Envoy and still are. So we went from 2013, grew, got all sorts of customers all around the, hey, people are doing a lot of things very manually in their workplace. They're kind of just accepting things the way they were. And then it really just started getting interesting. Like we built this visitors product. People saw it. They liked it. They brought it to their own office. And it just kept on spreading because people like a great experience when they're expecting a very burdensome, very security-focused, no-experience-focused thing. So this has just grown over the years. We've built multiple products. And then recently, COVID has been really exciting, too. I mean, now suddenly here's a workplace, a physical workplace company, and hey, they're closing all the workplaces because there's a virus running around. So yeah, it's definitely been really interesting. But hey, we very quickly pivoted to our whole concept of Envoy Protect, which is this whole thing around, hey, how do we return people to the office that have to be there? And how do we do that safely? So it's like the people that do need to go there, how can we make sure they're distanced from people, that there's not too many people in an office, that they haven't had COVID and that they don't actually have it.
Right.
So there's a lot of really good stuff that we're doing. So yeah, pretty exciting.
Right. Yeah, I think like I've actually used Envoy, especially the sign-in tool. It's a fantastic tool. In fact, it's used by a ton of organizations out there. I think I've visited Stripe and other organizations, and they've have it in their main centers there. But like you said, obviously the pandemic days have been forcing businesses to change their business models. Now you mentioned it just a little bit. I want to get into that. How has the pandemic forced Envoy to pivot a little bit and change its business model?
Yeah, I mean, well, think about it, right? Like it's one of the first things anybody did with their business when the pandemic started is that's it. Everybody's got to go home. And then the companies literally had rules. Even if you wanted to go to the office, you could not. So it was really interesting because, I mean, at first we were like, oh, cool. Okay, this is interesting. The whole world is changing. This is fun. We can deal with fast movement. But it's a little different when it's like, but wait a second. Our core business relies on us being able to sell the businesses. The fact that they can like register visitors and book their meeting rooms and book like different receiving of packages, those are no longer really necessary when you think about it at first in a pandemic environment where everyone's at home. So yeah, that was definitely pretty interesting, that's for sure. But yeah, we discovered that there's a lot more going on in the office, and especially a lot of businesses, 40% of businesses, we just published a study recently, 40% of businesses actually never actually ended up leaving. People just kept on going. So these are factories, warehouses. So those ones were the early ones to show, hey, there's still some way of doing it where it's safe. They were way more distanced from each other. They had policies like wearing masks and all that, but they still needed some way to know who's in the office today and who's in the warehouse. And from there, we started building a really great suite of different offerings around a density mapping, around hot desking, around so many other pieces that now are translated to a more kind of tech companies that as they're going back, they're seeing, oh, hey, this is actually like, okay, we've got some good tooling here to make sure that we can be as safe as possible. So yeah, it's been a ride, that's for sure. But it's never been more interest and more users and more interest in just a suite, which is incredible considering that we built for something the pandemic literally affected.
Right. Yeah, it's. I think it's great that you guys have a suite here because I think there's a lot of tools. In fact, you know, we even have these tools that when you're going back to the office, you have to, you know, check, do like a health check-in. And of course, that's one tool. Yep. And then you have another tool for one other thing, you know, making sure that you, you know, you let them know if you, you know, if you're taking hardware or something like that, right? There's like a bunch of tools that you need, and they're usually in different systems. So it's very interesting to hear that this is one suite. I think one ask I'm curious about is what are organizations asking for here? Obviously, I just talked about one, which is the health check-in one. But what is some of the other tools they're asking for?
Yeah, so it's the health part is definitely, that's the common denominator. Everybody wants some form of that. They just want to know, hey, have you been near someone that was sick? Are you sick? Have you been outside of the state? But it gets more interesting where, okay, now once they've said that, no, they're safe, then you're still not done, because what happens is the day when you actually show up to the office, then they only unlock your access badge to get into the building if you've cleared that. So they literally check your the database, and we facilitate this through our software, but it then unlocks your badge for that day. So they know nobody else inside that office is actually like everyone's registered there. So they know if something were to break out, they know who was in there. And then other parts of it is things around like, well, okay, now you need to be assigned a desk. And that desk needs to be near your team, but not too near the team. So we helped them kind of do a whole map around it. And we announced a private beta of this a few weeks ago. And it's coming soon that we're going to be announcing this for everyone. And it's really exciting because it's taking it kind of to that next level where it's like, not only do you know who's in the office, but you're being particularly diligent about making sure people aren't too close to each other, but still enough so they can talk to each other. And that's a big part. The social aspect of the workplace is enormous. And I think that this is what's driving a lot of people to go back in some form. But all companies are still only doing like 10, 15, 20%, unless they have to be there, in which case it's a different story.
Right. Now, you said something interesting here. Obviously, you know, you have a lot of these tools to help, you know, customers and organizations jumpstart, and you know, obviously social distancing and so on and so forth. But one thing that a lot of organizations are worried about here is the fact of is around privacy. So, you know, obviously there's a fine line between sharing data and, you know, contact tracing and distancing and so on and so forth. But there's also privacy. People don't want to be tracked, or they don't want to, you know, stuff like that. So how is Envoy dealing with that? And what have you seen from an organization's perspective?
Yeah, that's a great point. So we are based in San Francisco, and if there's one thing about San Francisco is that people are hyper privacy conscious, and they want to make sure that like, whoa, what do you mean you're asking me about my medical history? So what we do literally, and we were the first company to do this, and the company that's still the most like insistent on it, is we don't upload the results of the questionnaire. We just say, did you pass or did you fail? And then that gets uploaded to the system. We don't say what it was or any detail like that. And then when we provide analytics to the company, it's always done in aggregate. It's always done in some way where it's like, well, what are you trying to do? Are you trying to get a general idea for what's going on? Or are you trying to like figure out which one person could potentially cause something? So we feel that companies typically want to get the details. They don't really want the details. They want to just know, hey, the whole office is clear today. Or, hey, if there was a problem, automatically notify the people. And sometimes they don't even want to know who it was. So it's but the person will notify the people that were around them. And I think that's when it really gets interesting, where it's there's such an opportunity for this to go the wrong way and for it to get like a airport security style world to exist now, where like temperature scanning is you have to walk in a machine, put your hands up, like it, and this is really like I think our real opportunity to make this super consumer friendly and make it something that's experience first, because you're not going to have that safety or security or the like making sure the virus doesn't spread and all that if everybody doesn't partake in it. So we really feel it's an important consumer motion that we're doing here. And that's what our company's been all about. Like our product grows because people like using it. And if they don't, and if there's a problem, they write us and we really, really try our best to fix things and make it easier. It's a tough battle though, because one person pays for it, the other one uses it. And there's always a conflict, but we feel like this is a really, really great challenge for us to partake in.
So one thing I'm actually interested in is obviously you do these surveys of people when they use the system for the first time or when they use it multiple times. And obviously organizations, like you just said, want customization. They want to be able to ask special things or other things. I'm curious, one, what is the canned set of things that you ask? And then do you also offer the capability to add additional things in there?
Yeah. This is a great question. And we've had this kind of question since the beginning around like, hey, why do you make me sign NDAs all the time? And it's actually really interesting because it's, so we don't write the NDAs. The NDAs are things that companies upload. We're no different from like a DocuSign that just hosts the thing and makes it easier to sign. Now, when it comes to COVID, there's questions that people have. And what we will do is we'll say like, here's some of the questions people use, but we don't try to populate it with our own opinions as to this, because there's just so many different regulations and laws and even different industries. Like an industry that deals with food has a very different set of questionnaires than an industry that's maybe like a construction site where they just need to keep track of the people. So it really does depend on the industry and all that. So we allow that customization. They can customize all sorts of like the questions, the things that are okay versus not okay. We let them customize their office map, of course, where are the seats, where are the meeting rooms that are near the seats so they know which ones to pair. How many people do you want maximum in your office? Even though there's seats for 100, maybe you only want to allow 10 for now, because in San Francisco, for example, you're allowed a certain percentage. I think it's like 25% right now, up to 25%. But in other states, it's fully closed. And in other states, it's fully open. So that configurability, even if we wanted to be opinionated on this, it just wouldn't make sense, because I think companies, at the end of the day, know their regulations a lot better than we do.
Right. Well, when we come back, we have a lot more to talk about with Larry. But before we get to that, we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Worldwide Technology, known simply as WWT. Now, WWT is one of the leading technology solution providers globally, delivering business and technology outcomes to large private and public organizations across the globe. Now, WWT is in the digital transformation business. And one of the ways they support organizations is with their digital transformations is by helping them adopt a multi-cloud architecture. And that's a hard thing to do. Now, they stay with organizations every step of the way, from cloud vision and strategy to cloud enablement and migration to cloud optimization and management and everything in between. Now, their cloud consultants sit down with customers to formulate a vision and a strategy with, you know, because WWT knows the cloud investments only pay off when they're aligned to business goals. They want to help. Now, through briefings and workshops, WWT helps some of the world's largest organizations unravel those complexities of the cloud to unlock business opportunities and potential. Now, experts in cloud migrations and application development, WWT can create a secure landing zone in any cloud. Now, with on-demand labs, they give organizations access to tools from microservices and cloud-native development. And once in the cloud, WWT actually helps with cloud management and optimization, because they know cloud is a continuum that requires constant attention to detail. Now, whether a strategy calls for cloud native, hybrid cloud, or on-prem resources, WWT works closely with Intel to optimize for the latest cloud smart solutions based on Intel technology for security, performance, and agility. Now, they also feature Intel Optane persistent memory and other Intel technologies, workload optimized to deliver affordable, large capacity and data persistence for solutions supporting everything from VDI to data analytics. To learn more and discover why organizations across industries turn to WWT to guide them on their cloud journeys, visit WWT.com/twit. And don't forget to create a My WWT account to access resources available through WWT's Advanced Technology Center ecosystem. That's WWT.com/twit. WWT, delivering business and technology outcomes around the world. And we thank WWT for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we've been talking with Larry Gadia. He's the CEO of Envoy. We've been talking about how businesses are actually pivoting, especially during the pandemic time. You know, I want to actually bring my co-host back in because they've been asking a bunch of questions behind the scenes here, and I'm sure they want to ask you some stuff, Larry. So I want to jump to Chibert first. Chibert?
Hey, Larry. I just retired from a fairly good-sized university, and a university is lots of buildings, multiple campuses in some cases, and so forth. What about access control? You know, what kinds of things, what kind of tie-ins, what kinds of APIs or hooks do you have in your system so that we can customize? You know, the university has a medical school. We have a cancer center that has HIPAA regulations, but we also have general classrooms. What kinds of things should a customer catalog or collect, or what kind of homework do they need to do to make that first conversation with you easier?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's honestly the security system integrations is part of what makes Envoy really shine. It's because we've always built integrations with different systems for uploading NDAs, for uploading information, or for enabling a badge, for example, for a contractor that's coming in. So we've integrated, I think it's about 10 or 11 different major door access security providers. This can be everything from like S2, Linnell, Genetec, to people like Keysi or OpenPath or Proxy. And these are all companies that what happens a lot of time is people just have a lot of buildings. And the buildings, oftentimes the security system is defined by the company that runs that building. And that's oftentimes not the tenant. So what we do is we integrate with basically all of them. And what we do is when you use your mobile app as an employee or as a student or as a faculty, you'll go in and you basically would use your phone. And this is kind of where we're going with this, where after you've done your clearing and you've done the survey, you're cleared for that data's capacity, it will then basically we hit your servers on the side to basically say, hey, open up this door on behalf of this person. And usually that'll just enable the badge where they can use their normal badge. But we're moving to a world now as well where it's like we can actually just literally trigger that door from your phone. So now you don't need to carry five different badges around, or maybe you go into another building in a different city that's by the same school or office or factory. So this is kind of where we're going. And the integrations today work just fine for enabling that door. You just got to know all your vendors that you use. And then some of them, there's API keys, but the stuff is very easy. And most of it is even self-serviceable too, to get started. We try to make things really easy for everyone involved. But yeah, even as complicated as security, it's important that you integrate as much as you can to still have that secure environment, but at the same time, also have this safety aspect that is so important with COVID now.
Fantastic. Thanks, Larry. I do want to bring Kurt in as well. Kurt?
Thanks, Lou. And Larry, I'm really curious because you've mentioned that there's this tension between the kind of data that companies often want about their employees and the data that employees are comfortable with their employers having. And I'm curious how you square that. Do you get a lot of interest from companies about wanting to know where their employees are at all times so that they can, let's say, encourage employees towards greater productivity, spending more time at their workstation? And how do you square that with the kind of privacy that most employees, especially in North America, feel that is their right?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And it's especially relevant now. what's interesting is I think people have more privacy at home these days because it's kind of like there's no one that literally could even look to see if you're at in your seat. So I think that's very interesting. But when you go into the workplace, I think that right now, well, I know that right now, well, we've talked to hundreds of companies directly that are basically saying, hey, if people want to go to the office, they can right now, but it's totally optional. People don't have to go into the office. Oftentimes what they have is there's two people in one bedroom, or there's a small house, or there's like jackhammering happening outside. So it's kind of like, if people go to the office, it's pretty tough to kind of use that as statistics for are people in their seat. Though it could get to that world maybe when everybody kind of goes back at some point. And it's kind of questionable if everybody will actually go back all in the same way it used to be. I think this hybrid future workplace is a very interesting concept that will change with time. But I think in that point, it's going to be about the aggregated statistics. Again, it's really important. Like, people will not adopt your safety and security practices if they feel that there's a privacy violation or if they feel like they got the short end of a stick. And we recognize that more than anyone. We work with something like 14,000 companies, and we've heard it all. So it's kind of really important that we do what's in the interest of the end users and the companies. And oftentimes, honestly, the companies don't even want that information. They were accidentally collecting it, and actually it's like, oh, I didn't even know we were collecting that. And then they turn it off. And this happens all the time with just configuration. So I think that like companies are starting to get more and more aligned. We're getting to get a lot more privacy conscious people also running things at companies. And they're realizing, hey, this isn't necessarily the best way of like assessing productivity. Maybe we should look at if they delivered the thing they were supposed to on time as the productivity measure, as opposed to if they're sitting in their chair. Kind of hard to see if somebody's sitting in their chair today.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the sitting in their chair, because we've been talking about people working at home versus people working in an office. But I know I've gotten an awful lot of solicitations from the various hotels where I'm, you know, part of their frequent sleeper program, talking about thinking of hotels as the new workplace. You know, if you're tired of your house and you can't go to an office, come on down to the local hotel and
that's
we'll take care of. You know, how does a system like yours work in that sort of circumstance, this almost third place working environment, whether it be a hotel, a co-working space, the local micro pub, you know, whatever it might be, how do you deal with those?
Well, let's hope that at the local micro pub they're actually getting some work done there. But this is a really good point, and this is the whole thing behind what we're thinking is going to be the hybrid workplace. I think, okay, let's think about it a little bit. We got the vaccine that people are working on right now. That vaccine is going to take, I don't know, there's like 150 or something of these being developed at one point right now. I think we're going to start seeing some good successes. I don't know. Let's just say in the next 6 months, we can start production of this stuff. Now we're rolling out this vaccine that was built in record time, and they're figuring out distribution of it too. That's going to take another maybe 6 months of like, let's get it so everyone could be vaccinated. All the meanwhile, people are going to be like, wow, this vaccine normally should take 10 years to make, and it only took about 1 year to make. Is this safe for me? So there will be a huge section of population that won't even take it. Even if it's out there and it's proven safe, they still will not take it. So that's another 6 months to 1 year. So we're looking at least 2 years of kind of this weird mode where it's not everybody is at home, but not everybody's at the office either. It's in this hybrid period where what's happening is people will be at home, at the office, at a co-working space, at a hotel, or at that micropub. Now, the thing is, it's kind of the workplace needs to adjust itself to help you with that. People, when they show up to the workplace, it may not be your workplace. It may be the co-working space down the street from you as opposed to the one downtown where you used to go. But you still get that space outside of your home. So your company needs to make it easy to, for example, book time over there, book a meeting room for you over there, book a hot desk over there. And at the same time, your people on your team need to also know that, hey, you're going to be at that co-working space. So if you need to work together, you can do that at that one, and it's going to book all of you. And all of you list down if you've been COVID tested recently or COVID vaccinated. And aggregating all of this in a group is really what's going to be interesting. And this is exactly the future that we're predicting for at least the next 2 years, possibly three or more. It's not that the workplace is going away. It's that it's going to be used in very different ways. And maybe if all these companies have all this extra real estate, hey, maybe they turn that into a co-working space too. They already have all the desks. They have the meeting rooms. They have all the different door access to get people in. Why not?
Right, right. Well, unfortunately, all good things have to come to an end. Larry, thank you so much for being here. We're running a little bit low on time, but we did want to give you a chance to tell the folks at home where they can learn more about Envoy and maybe even get started.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're at envoy.com, envoy.com. Very simple. And it's basically, we're here to kind of revolutionize the workplace and how people do things there. It's about safety. It's about bringing people back in a very contained and very deliberate way. But it's about doing it with the experience first and doing it in a way that's going to expand for the future. We've never built more products faster right now. And we've never kind of thought about this better than this is a huge opportunity for the world to really kind of leverage the fact that they can be anywhere. They can be at home. They can be at the office. They can be at a co-working space. And we've helped over 1.5 million people so far go back to their workplaces. This is amongst over 1,000 companies now. And this just amass with all the visitors and all the other tooling around meeting rooms and deliveries. It's a pretty interesting time for the workplace. And we're really, really excited to be able to innovate at every step of the way. And we'd love your feedback. And this is something that we really just love doing. So thank you so much for having me here.
Thanks again. Well, folks, you've done it again. You sat through another hour of the Best Dang Enterprise podcast in the universe. So tune your podcatcher to Twyatt. And I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible because it's definitely a team effort. And we have the best team in the world. Starting with our geek in paradise, Mr. Brian Chi Chibert. What's going on for you in the coming weeks and where can people find you online?
The clock is ticking. I'm getting very close to moving. Looking forward to this big change in my life. But you know what? I want to hear from you. Twyatt is nothing without our viewer feedback. We want to listen to you. We want to hear from you. We want your show ideas. So why don't you drop me a line? If you're into Twitter, I'm ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab. Better yet, I'm also Chibert at twit.tv. Or, you know, why don't you use Twyatt at twit.tv because that'll hit all the hosts. We've had lots of great feedback. We've had all kinds of interesting comments, some good, some bad. Who knows? That's all right. This show is driven by our viewers, is driven by you. So toss us a line. Tell us what you think. I've got thick skin. Love to hear from you. Take care, everybody. See you next week.
Thank you, Chibert. Well, we also have to thank Mr. Curtis Franklin as well. He's the senior editor over there at Dark Reading. Curtis, you've alluded to a couple things coming up this week. What else is coming up for you, and where can people find you and all your work?
Well, as usual, people can find me at Dark Reading and especially over at The Edge of Dark Reading. I've got a number of things coming up, ranging from a piece on the kind of vulnerabilities that people overlook these days, those that come from printers being in the office, all the way to a number of great interviews I've got, both on some of the talks that are going to be happening at Black Hat Europe, to a program that's going on that's in these times helping people who have lost their jobs pivot to a career in cybersecurity. So lots of interesting stuff going on. Please come over and find me. And as always, I'll be posting about these and other articles on my Twitter feed at KG4GWA and over on Instagram at Kurt_Franklin.
Thank you, Kurt. Well, folks, we also have to thank you as well. You're the person who drops in each and every week to watch and listen to our show to get your enterprise and IT goodness. We want to make it easy for you to get your enterprise news. So go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twyatt. There you'll find all the amazing back episodes, the information about the hosts, the co-hosts, the guest information, and of course, links to our stories that we do during the show. But more importantly, next to those videos, you'll get those helpful subscribe and download links. Support the show by getting your audio version, your video version of your choice, and listen on any one of your devices. Use your podcast, your application, any one of them. We're on there, so definitely subscribe and get your IT and enterprise news. It's really the best way to stay on top of it, so might as well subscribe. Now, after you subscribe, you can impress your friends, your family, your coworkers with the gift of Twiat, because I'll tell you one thing. We talk a lot about some fun stuff on Twiat here, and they, I guarantee they'll definitely be interested as well. So definitely share Twiat with them and have them subscribe as well. Now, if you've already subscribed and you're available each and every Friday, 1:30 p.m. Pacific, we do this show live. You can check it out at live.twit.tv. Come see how the piece is made. Come see the behind the scenes and all the banter and fun stuff that we do here at Twit. Of course, that's, again, live.twit.tv. And, of course, if you're going to watch the show live, you might as well jump into the fabulous Twit chat room live as well. There's a bunch of great characters in there. We have some great discussions and some good conversations, and they sometimes direct the show in different directions. So check that out at irc.twit.tv. Now, if you can't watch the show live but you still want to be part of the amazing community that we have, like I mentioned before, you can check out the 24/7 discussion at our new community website. That's twit.community. There we have all the hosts out there, the communities out there, some great discussions about content, guests, hosts, even all of our shows. So definitely check that out. That's twit.community. 24/7, great discussion, great time. And remember, you can always follow me, twitter.com/LouMM. There I post all the great enterprise tidbits that I have. Of course, I also have some great conversations with people like you. But more importantly, I actually post some of the things I do at Microsoft and how you can make your office more productive for you and your organization. But I do want to make sure I thank everyone who makes the show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support This Week in Enterprise Tech each and every week, and we couldn't do the show without their support. So thank you for all of their support. Of course, thank all the engineers and the staff at Twit. Of course, I want to also thank Mr. Brian Schiebert one more time. He's not only our co-host, but he's also our tireless producer. He does all the show bookings and all the plannings for the show, and we really couldn't do the show without him. So thank you again, Schiebert, for all your hard work there. This Twiat wouldn't be the same without you. Now, before we sign out, we have to thank our editor, Victor. He's behind the scenes making us look great. But, of course, also the man behind the scenes making us look great live here is Mr. Ant Pruitt. And what's going on for you in this week on Twit?
Still doing what we do. Had a great week with hands-on photography and hands-on wellness. Go check those out right now.
Absolutely, absolutely. And until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twiat.
Want more Twit? Well, you gotta check out iOS Today. That's the show where Leo Laporte and I cover everything you need to know about iOS. It's the best apps, the best games, and everything you can do with your iPad, your iPhone, and your Apple Watch, plus CarKit and so much more. Twit.tv/iOS.